So tell me about growing up.
I'm the oldest of five siblings. I was born to an amazing mother, Japanese Thai woman, who actually was a naturalized U.S. citizen, and I brought to Wyoming with my U.S. Air Force veteran father. Dad was a Wyoming native, musician, and a surveyor, and he served about 5 years in the U.S. Air Force in Japan and was out a year before my birth. He had my mom leave a college scholarship and a great job to come to the U.S. after meeting her during his tour in Japan. My mom had seen World War II, really from the eyes of a five-year-old, which didn't necessarily go well with my grandparents that had lived and served in the Pacific Theater. My grandfather was an Army veteran of that conflict, and there weren't very many Asians in Wyoming then. My mom had it rough going for a long time. So growing up in Wyoming was the equivalent of paradise, even with the 9 months of winter of below zero temperatures and snow. It is a mineral-rich state, has less than 500,000 people. Schools and teachers were amazing, and I grew up in a neighborhood of lifelong childhood friends from kindergarten through my senior year. I had three brothers and my sister. We were basically 1 year apart, and we went to school, sports, and shared friends together. We weren't very rich as a family, but we were happy. Mom and Dad ensured we were well-dressed, fed, and enjoyed our holidays, vacations. I grew up playing Army with my neighborhood friends and family, and I like to joke, after all, you never heard a kid say, let's play Navy.
Oh, you're right about that. What were your deployment years like growing up? So what were your developmental years like growing up?
I grew up pretty disciplined. I was raised in Catholic faith as an altar boy for 15 years. Cub Scout, Boy Scout, did track, football, basketball, martial arts, hunting, camping, fishing, and had a great interest in the service. I wasn't very outspoken or outgoing with my classmates, but I was a varsity athlete, straight A student, and had a lot of friends. I was pretty quiet as a kid and tried hard in everything I attempted. Ended up being selected for the American Legion Boys State and the close-up program, which took kids from each state to Washington, D.C. And then I also served as an exchange student in Japan for the summer. I ventured out of Wyoming in these programs, which helped broaden my perspective and my horizons and how I saw the rest of the world. I ended up getting a full-ride honor scholarship to the University of Wyoming, which I passed on to someone else.
Wow, that's amazing. When did you first know you wanted to go into the military?
I had always envisioned myself in the military, usually flying jets for the Air Force, but my elementary years are filled with the Vietnam War on television. I made a decision to apply to all the service academies to see what would happen. My coach is very supportive, although I had one particular teacher or counselor that actually tried to persuade me against the military, feeling I wouldn't be a good fit. Fortunately, another took me under her wings and actually helped me fill out the applications and get started. And she's been an Air Force officer's spouse and has been a supporter and a friend to this day.
Wow, what a blessing. How did you know which of the services you wanted to join and what your specialty would be?
I actually applied to all the service academies and ended up being the right thing to do. My applications had been accepted by the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, Air Force Academy, Naval Academy, and Coast Guard Academies. And in addition to receiving nominations from our two centers, I got a lone congressman, Dick Cheney, who also gave me an appointment. So I went through the arduous application process, medical exams, and had unfortunate discovery that I was colorblind. Navy and Coast Guard disqualified me. Air Force was willing to take me without allowing me to fly, and West Point was willing to waive the vision qualification. I attended West Point. I graduated with the class of 1987 and was commissioned an infantry officer in the United States Army. And that institution has shaped my ideas about selfless service, importance of teamwork, friends, values, and living an ethic as a military leader character. It was actually a perfect fit for me and the man I would become. I enjoyed my time as a cadet. I excelled in leadership and physical fitness, although my high school straight A's turned into a 2.79 GPA. I had earned the parachutist badge as a cadet and was selected to be a cadet captain. And I was a company commander as a cadet, my first opportunity to really lead. I ended up choosing infantry as my branch in Fort Lewis, Washington for my first assignment.
Wow. How did you meet your wife?
During graduation leave from West Point, I stopped in for a month at home in Gillette, Wyoming, and stayed at my parents' house. I managed to meet a beautiful young woman at the Holiday Inn Bar in Gillette, Wyoming, who I immediately fell in love with, asked her to marry me after 2 weeks of meeting and knowing each other. Heather had no idea what she was getting into when she said yes, and I went off 2 weeks later to beautiful Fort Benning, Georgia, the home of the infantry, and the most humid, hottest place I'd been to date to finish up Ranger School. Infantry Officer Basic Course was also during that time, and similar to the training I'd received at West Point, had a lot of classmates that were there with me. I ended up graduating on the Commandant's list and then started at the U.S. Army Ranger School at Fort Benning, Georgia. And that course helped me understand how to lead when everyone is cold, wet, hungry, tired, and pissed off, or half conscious. And of course, I have the bragging rights of being a Winter Ranger going November through March. The bigger bragging right was I ended up being the guy that got married during Ranger School. In the short week they gave us for Christmas holidays, I ended up having my wedding in the Wyoming snow. I was happy to have married my beautiful wife and became a father of 1-year-old boy the same day. I often went back to Ranger School and didn't see my bride again until after graduation, driving to pick her up and Brandon in Wyoming and then traveling en route to Fort Lewis, Washington. We moved into government quarters and I left again for a month of field training at Yakima, Washington. And Heather, my wife, with all 20 years of life experience, was left to move in on her own and find her way around post. She managed to navigate the post exchange, the commissary hospital, and met some other wives, and they soon became great friends. She also learned and went on to serve by my side for my entire career and beyond. We had our second son, Scott, just a year after our marriage. A second lieutenant, I was married, had an amazing wife, 2 wonderful boys, all by the age of 24. So there's something about marrying up a tough Wyoming woman who knows what it means when you say cowboy up.
That's fantastic. She sounds like quite a woman. What was your first assignment?
I started off as an infantry platoon leader, a brand new butter bar second lieutenant training 30 men for combat. My first deployment ended up being out to put forest fires out in Montana. I actually led a light attack platoon, anti-tank platoon, and served as an XO, which is executive officer for several companies. It was a good start to what would be a 30-year Army career.
Wow. Tell me about some of the places you served over so many years.
Yeah, so 30 years, I ended up serving in Fort Lewis, Washington, then went to Fort Benning, Georgia, then as a company commander deploying to Kuwait for Operation Vigilant Warrior, which was following Desert Storm. As a captain then, I got my first opportunity to qualify in the Bradley Fighting Vehicle and had main line lights and gunnery qualifications. This is my first operational deployment with live ammunition in my weapons. Spent the 5th year there as an infantry branch representative for the Army's personnel command before moving on to California. Then we're at Fort Irwin, California, the National Training Center, where I trained the Army's mechanized companies and battalion task forces in the Mojave Desert. And then I had the first chance to go to an overseas assignment in Tabuk, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, from 1998 to 1999. And I did training and assisting with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia Army as a major. I also learned to advance my swimming skills. I took scuba diving in the Red Sea, ended up diving 100 times and visiting neighboring Egypt, Jordan, and Israel. I learned a lot about the Middle East then, and it proved to be invaluable as I went on to serve there most of my deployed career. So this was our first year apart as a family, and I was able to have my family in Wyoming with relatives, which helped at least ease the burden of being separated for so long.
Wow, my goodness. When did you first experience hardship? What was that like?
I was at Fort Stewart, Georgia. It was my longest and most trying assignment. As a young major, I started out on the garrison staff running the deployments of the 3rd Infantry Division for a year. I managed the airfield, rail load, ship load, and convoys, along with the moving parts to make the deployment successful. I also served on the G3 Division staff as a training manager for ranges, training areas, and large deployment exercises for the brigades and divisions. But one of my first disappointments was not making the what was then 50% cut to attend the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. So the Command and General Staff College is where majors go to learn their trade and go into the key and essential positions of operational officer and executive officer at the battalion higher levels.
How did that make you feel?
Well, not making the resident course automatically made you a second-class citizen in the world of majors. Ended up doing the correspondence course, which did it while I was earning my master's in aeronautical science from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University and while serving in the G3 shop as a training officer. I was driven, but felt my career being shortened by being the non-select guy, a non-select correspondence grad. Discrimination set in, and those that had gone out to the residence course went on to be XOs and S3s in infantry and armored battalions. And after 2 years on garrison and division staff, paying my dues, earning my way and catching up with my peers, I knew that learning all the ins and outs of how the post and division operated made me even a better S3 and XO when I finally got down to the battalion.
When was your first deployment overseas?
Well, when 9/11 actually happened, shortly after, I quickly found myself deployed with Task Force China, which is 3rd Battalion, 15th Infantry, back to Kuwait for 6 months in 2002. And really, the country stood on the brink of war as we listened to President Bush talk about chemical weapons in Iraq and the threat to attack if Saddam Hussein did not step down from power.
What was your first time in combat?
I fought in Baghdad on 7 April 2003 with the Lead Brigade Combat Team, 2nd Brigade Combat Team of 3rd Infantry Division, and that was into a city of 5 million people. We didn't have a good read on what the enemy looked like inside of Baghdad, since most of our intelligence sources were on the outskirts of the city. And this would be the capture of Baghdad, the attack in, and which was really the epitome of urban combat. Is densely compacted buildings and streets full of population where distinguishing the enemy from civilians was almost impossible because we're all fighting in the same, they're all fighting in the same clothes, which were civilian clothes, not uniforms for the most part, except for the Republican Guard. I got to see my first combat casualties that day also. Our mission as the infantry task force was to seize three successive intersections along Highway 8 leading into the heart of Baghdad. And this would allow the lead tank battalion to bust in the city for what would become known as a thunder run. And then 2 days prior to our attack, the tank battalion had conducted the first thunder run. They moved through Baghdad and exited to the west near the Baghdad International Airport. And every tank got hit with gunfire, rocket-propelled grenades at that point. And the fact they made it through the city was amazing. The fact they got asked to do it again 2 days later was absurd. Sometimes things just actually go down in history and become books and movies. Accounts of this Thunder Run battle for Baghdad would find its way into multiple books. It includes Thunder Run by David Zucchino, Operation Cobra 2, and On Point. So what I found out is names matter, which we really didn't put a lot of thought in when my staff and the Tactical Operations Center named our three objectives after the Three Stooges, objectives Curly, Larry, and Moe.
Did you have any casualties that you witnessed?
Yes, as we planned the next assault into the city, I knew that we'd have casualties. The plan was a second thunder run. It'd be a quick lightning attack in the city and a left turn out to the airport like last time. And we didn't have much information on what to expect. During our mission brief, one of our medics ran up to me and said, David Bloom is down. So David Bloom was an embedded anchor with NBC. He died of vein thrombosis. And he had lived with us for months as we trained in the desert and prepared our attack in Iraq. He had actually learned to survive in the desert with our help. And he rode with us, conducted live broadcasts on television, did Bible study with us, and became a member of our team. It was a great loss to have him pass. We seized three objectives as we kept the resupply routes open for our tank battalion and refused the enemy the opportunity to surround them. We actually were fighting for over 8 hours that day, and the enemy was actually dug into 360 degrees around us. On that intersection, we had heavy direct and indirect fire and all launched into our positions. We held and continued to engage enemy fighters and took over 30 prisoners that day. As I monitored the radio, our brigade commander, Colonel Dave Perkins, told the division commander that he had made it to the center of Baghdad and could stay. He didn't need to have the tanks depart as it had done 2 days before, and the tanks actually became low on ammunition and fuel, and they would have been left just sitting ducks in the middle of 5 million people. But my battalion commander asked if we could get a resupply convoy to the city to resupply tanks, and my answer was yes. We made the decision for the resupply convoy to push north along Highway 8 to our position so we could push the needed supplies into the city to the tank battalions. We knew the going would be rough, and the enemy knew where we were. Many of our supply vehicles were soft-skin vehicles, meaning no armor. They'd be susceptible to enemy fire all along the route. And since our platoon of Bradley fighting vehicles was really the only firepower we had of significance on the objective Curly where I was at, I made a decision to have the convoy come up the road by itself. For me, that was the first time I thought I might not make it home. I prayed to God to get me back alive to my family as well as those I was leading that day. Heavy fire raked through our position, and we took many casualties. Our scout platoon sergeant, First Class Marshall, was actually cut down by a rocket-propelled grenade, almost blew him in half as he was launched up and out of the vehicle. A Humvee. His body would not be recovered until days later as the convoy had to fight out the ambush and continue along the route. One of our maintenance sergeants, Staff Sergeant Stever, was manning the 50 caliber machine gun on top of his M113 personnel carrier as the convoy rolled north, and a well-aimed RPG would strike his heavy machine gun and killed him as he dropped down inside the troop compartment. Some of that fire came from a friendly unit moving north on the highway that mistook us for enemy fighters. Had some close calls as 25mm depleted uranium rounds from a friendly Bradley fighting vehicle punched holes through my M577 command post vehicle like a hot knife through butter. I waited for the inevitable penetration of hot metal through my body as I continued command and control on the radios and I actually laid down in the vehicle, thinking that would keep them from going through my body. Stayed in contact with our brigade, higher headquarters, and our internal battalion net. So you think about dying, but are too busy to have it lock you up with fear. You continue to function, knowing that soldiers depend on you to do your job, to function. Courage doesn't mean you're not afraid. It just means you keep on going regardless.
Wow. What was it like occupying a city of 5 million people?
We'd eventually move into the city, join the tanks. It was an extremely long night, and we fueled and resupplied our own ammunition, keeping watch in the dark, not sure what was happening in the city around us. We occupied the surrounding palaces and Saddam's houses in the area, and up at the Ba'ath Party headquarters, and had the first shower in 21 days. We quickly planned a memorial service for our three comrades. The chaplain would lead the service, and we had comments from the commander and prayers, but I felt the need to have taps played. We had no music. We had a bullhorn, and I had my harmonica that I always carried. So I convinced my battalion commander that I could play it well enough and that it would bring more meaning to the ceremony. It actually aired live over several national news programs, and my wife happened to catch me playing taps on television. So we'd done it. We'd captured Baghdad. I'd spend the next month living in Saddam's son's housing compound. A surreal moment I vividly remember is playing guitar for Easter Mass on Saddam's balcony at the Al Jasud Palace in Baghdad, overlooking the Tigris River. I made a guitar pick out of an AT&T phone card and actually kept it to pass down to the grandkids. After a month of hard occupation of the city, we got the orders to move my unit from Baghdad to Fallujah, and we knew we'd redeploy home soon. Our spirits stayed high, even though as we continued our mission. And then I received a radio call from my brigade that I was not selected for promotion to lieutenant colonel. So another shattering moment in my 30-year career. I was stunned with yet another defeat.
How did that make you feel?
Well, after busting my butt and fighting into Baghdad, the Army saw fit for me to wait a whole another year. I eventually was promoted to lieutenant colonel after redeploying from Iraq and serving a year with the training support brigade that supported the Georgia National Guard. I go from there back to 3rd Infantry Division to a new 4th Brigade Combat Team just a year later, just in time to deploy to Iraq for another year of combat. I served as a brigade XO, deputy commander, and assumed command of the attached California Army National Guard Battalion. It was 1st Battalion, 184th Infantry. After the commander was relieved, his replacement was killed by an IED, and I was a third choice in line to lead the battalion through the remaining time in Iraq. And I would do what I never expected to do, assume command of a unit in combat. We had a very tough area, and IEDs were ripping through heavily armored vehicles and tanks. We ended up losing over 50 in the brigade and 18 in the battalion.
What was it like to personally having your soldiers hurt and some killed?
Well, visiting the combat surgical hospital in the Green Zone was always humbling and disturbing. I saw heads of burned soldiers swollen like basketballs. It looked like they'd burst at any instant. Limbs were missing or heavily bandaged. I'd have a member of my personnel security detachment take a sniper's bullet and die in front of me while we worked on him, waiting on the medevac arrival. The enemy began targeting the aircraft and vehicles that came up to help those in the initial IED ambush and exploded secondary devices. One day they used pressure-activated devices. Next, it was command detonated with cell phones. They hid the explosives in animals on the side of the road, dug and repaved asphalt, hung explosives from overpasses, and kept us constantly adjusting their tactics.
How did you cope with the fact that the enemy is trying to kill you?
The possibility of dying every time you go out and leave the gate, and not having total control of the threat in your environment brings a sense of acceptance of your mortality. You could die at any time. You also realize that every time you chamber a bullet in your weapon, you're prepared to kill anyone that threatens your life or those with whom you serve. No one despises war more than those of us who have to fight it. And that keeps you fighting the people to your left and right.
You went back to Iraq for a second year deployment. What was that like?
It was ironic that my area of operation included what had been an objective Curlie. It's now an Iraqi checkpoint for Highway 8, so same location. But this time it's manned by the Iraqi 4th Public Order Brigade. And while I was on the rooftop overlooking that position during the command and control joint mission with an Iraqi unit, there was an Iraqi general with me, beside me, and I said, "See that intersection?" He goes, "Yeah." And I said, "I was there 2 years ago during the attack in Iraq." He looked at me sternly and said, "That was you? There's still bullet holes in my house from you." So I waited for a tense moment and expected to be thrown off the roof, and then erupted in a deep belly laugh, and I found that war does have a sense of humor.
What was coming home like?
Redeployed almost exactly a year since I left home for Kuwait and Iraq. My wife and two boys welcomed me with open arms on the parade field at Fort Stewart, Georgia. And I've never had such a rush of love and thankfulness at being allowed to come home to my family while others were still there fighting. I felt guilty and ashamed. I could have done better. What could I have done better for the troops? Could we have trained harder? My judgments, preparation, training, orders, moving soldiers into the enemy, you can never do enough to prepare. We can only do the best what we can do with the time available. After my second combat tour in Iraq, the Army selected me to command a basic training battalion at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. I spent 2 years shaping civilians into combat-ready soldiers in 9 weeks. So as we were prepared to drive from Georgia to Missouri, we left our eldest son, Brandon, in Hinesville, Georgia. He didn't want to leave his girlfriend in 2 years, was attending college, working, and was ready to be on his own. We got him an apartment, gave him a truck, and moved to Missouri with our youngest son, Scott, who is now a high school senior. During this first 30 days of my command, we received the worst news that we could ever receive, the worst news of our lives, that Brandon took his own life, dying by suicide. We never saw it coming, and it brought us to our knees. We survived through the family friendships of not only our relatives, but our Army family, which still supports us today in our loss and grief. Somehow we made it through his burial back in Georgia, and our youngest son finished his senior year, and then he moved to Florida to attend college at the University of Central Florida, and he was really still heartbroken after the loss of his big brother just that year.
How did your life go on after the loss of your son?
Now, from 2008 to 2011, I was at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, as part of U.S. Special Operations Command, and this is the first time I ever asked the Army to send me to a specific place. We were still grieving the loss of Brandon, and the Army had done what it had asked for the first time, is get me close to where my youngest son was going to school, and they did just that by getting me to Florida.
What was the rest of your career like at this point? Did you deploy again?
I enjoyed 3 years there in Florida and its unique mission towards the global war on terrorism. Special Operations Force that commanded. This was the hub of the fight and tip of the spear for the command of our Special Operations Forces worldwide, and I was proud to work there. I traveled all over the world and spent weeks in Pentagon fighting to get approval and funding for new concepts that supported Special Operations for the next decade. And it was a unique, broadening experience. I'd learned about the combatant level of my profession. This is the highest staff level for warfighting that I ever served at, and I was promoted to the rank of colonel, and eventually was selected to attend the resident course for the Senior Service College at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And I was pretty happy about that, having been not selected for Command and Staff College. I earned my Master's of Strategic Studies degree while I was there, and then learned I'd be deploying to Afghanistan for a year of command following graduation from the War College. So I prepared myself with as much information as possible. I took courses on the area and its people. I was commanding 800 service members organization under NATO with all 5 U.S. military services, 9 countries, fending off terrorists and safe havens and Taliban threats with Afghan army and police partners. I found myself flying and driving the entire eastern side of Afghanistan-Pakistan border, visited over 20 forward operating bases where my forces were occupied and trained. And after a year long in combat there, we lost 2 soldiers, actually from Guamanian National Guard, a security detachment. I returned home, moved us from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where my wife kept the home front for a year while I was gone, and we moved to our new assignment at West Point, New York.
That's amazing you got to go back where you started. Tell me about that.
West Point would be my final assignment. It would allow me to serve my final 4 years in the Army at the place I started all. I had the privilege of serving at the Army's Center of the Army Profession and Ethic, so it was called CAPE, and I developed the Army's doctrine on the profession and worked with the other joint service to assist in the effort for the Department of Defense. Culminated my career as a liaison officer for the Army's Training and Doctrine Command, and I wasn't selected for general officer. I was retiring honorably as a colonel, having served as long as the U.S. Congress would allow me to.
What was it like to retire after such a long career?
It came fast, and with some sadness and leaving the only thing I'd known since age 18, I was leaving a mission while the fight was still going on. I was thankful to be able to pass my knowledge to the future officers of the Army at West Point, and thankful they still asked me for my advice. My retirement started without fanfare, no ceremony, packing up 2 cars with my wife and driving from New York to California. I left the service as I'd come in, but with a new sense of adventure and what would lie ahead. We're all replaceable, and the institution will continue long after we're gone. I was once asked by a mentor, what is a servant entitled to? The answer is nothing. During my service, I went where and when the Army sent us. I spent full years away from my wife and kids when you add it all up. And if you add up long hours at work, month-long periods training out in the field, and small deployments in support of other nations, I'd probably spend a decade away from them. They said that military families serve too, and this could never be truer. After 30 years, I was finally putting my family first.
What do you reflect on since you've been retired?
Having to go to combat hospitals to visit those men and women permanently injured, burned, amputated, mentally shattered, still tears at my heart. I'm humbled and ashamed to have come back in one piece, able to function in my daily life. Having to write, call, and visit the families of those killed was one of the most painful duties that my wife and I shared. Having lost my son, I know our greatest fear is those whom we love will be forgotten as people go on with their lives while we continue to live our lives with part of us missing.
How is life as a retiree?
My life now is very satisfying. I can look back on my service, humble, but at the same time honored to be part of such a profession as the military. I was fortunate to continue to serve in the assistance and promotion of veterans and their families and active forces. I spend days with my wife, son, daughter-in-law, and grandkids now. I've renewed family ties with siblings and parents and reflect with lifelong friends reunited. Proud to be a veteran. I do have my days of depression, anxiety, body aches, and pains, and I'd do it all over again. For the most part, I'm enjoying life, still feel I'm serving with a purpose and contributing to our society in a meaningful way.
What was transition like?
My life as a veteran started off hard and disappointing. I had chosen to move to California before securing employment, knowing that as a retired colonel with two master's degrees, I could find a job. But after 8 months of unemployment, I was devastated. I used my last 6 months of my GI Bill to attend community college and received 6 months of basic housing allowance, which helped with the rent in Orange County. I even went to Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, to work as a contractor until I was hired by Goodwill Industries of Orange County to serve as their director for the Tierney Center for Veteran Services, where I currently work. I joined California State Guard and was promoted to brigadier general and assumed command of the new Army component, which is about 800 people. I followed assignment by being appointed as deputy commanding general for the 40th Infantry Division, California Army National Guard. Even though I couldn't be in the National Guard, I am a deputy commander with responsibility for defense support to civil authorities, or DISCA. So focused on leading the effort in support of the state's first response for fires, earthquakes, floods, and other emergencies. And I'm glad I kept a couple of uniforms and boots to do it, and I'm proud to continue to serve, and this time is for the state of California.
If you could tell the American public any message, what would it be?
Well, veterans come from warrior culture, and we're trained to fight and win our nation's wars. We're a profession, and I believe the most honorable profession. We volunteer to give our lives if called upon to do so, and this is the only profession where we kill other humans as part of our mission, and we have to be able to do that. This never leaves you. So veterans, I believe, do not transform themselves, and I argue that we don't even transition. I believe we go through a new mission in a new environment. And right now, there's a growing chasm of understanding between the society we serve and the 7% of Americans called veterans, and that chasm is even growing deeper. So as we leave the military service, we continue to serve. It's our nature to do so. It's a new mission in a new environment. We bring character, confidence, commitment, values, teamwork, and leadership to our new employment, as well as our neighborhoods and cities. So it's imperative that we tell our story. Unfortunately, most of us don't. We're a humble profession. And unfortunately, rarely admit being a veteran, much less tell about what that means and things we did. Much of what is known about veterans is from television or movies, and unfortunately, a lot of that's not the best things. We've got some of our brothers and sisters that continue to struggle, but for the most part, this is a minority of our veterans. And we are starting to help them into their society and welcome them home. Most of us are doing okay, and we can help others if we're asked. So I'd ask everybody to invest in us, continue to support and defend the Constitution. We will do that. Anytime we can help with our fellow brothers and sisters that are veterans, we'll continue to do that. And we'll continue to be our country's repository of all the customs, traditions, and values that make us American. And I truly believe that our veterans are leading the way and carry that torch for our country, for everyone else that didn't serve but continues to support us. And it's much appreciated. It's a proud profession. I'm so glad I was a part of it. And I'm very happy that I was able to spend 30 years and still as a civilian continue to serve.